afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe, and I'm glad you're with us today. Our goal on Central Coast Voices, among other things, is to bring you credible, valid information and insights about diverse things within our community, both members of our community, projects in the community, and things that are just happening. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes there are things that are going on a daily basis, and that's one of the topics we'll talk about today. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of change, or in some cases, lack of change in our society. It's come up with both sides of that, and it's been a lively discussion before. Our topic today is learning inspired by nature. Every child deserves a place to grow. And yes, that may be a play on words we'll get into and explain a little bit better. My guests today are the executive director and the education director of One Cool Earth. That's actually the name of the organization. And for all of us children of the 60s, an organization called One Cool Earth is really kind of a neat topic. Even though thankfully my guests were probably not part of the 60s, and they're looking at a longer-term vision than that. One Cool Earth is an organization creating basically a peaceful, abundant planet with healthy environmental things for everybody. And they're doing that by helping students and community members create an outdoor educational space. And we say outdoor, think environmental, yes. And they're doing that in both schools, with neighborhood gardens, and with community tree plantings. They believe, and they're correct, that real education takes place where ideas and youth connect. So that there's an opportunity for that to happen, and there should be opportunities for that to happen outside of the classroom. And one of the key things to doing garden and environmental issues is addressing them outside the classroom, which is good for everybody. It gives students who are used to being in the classroom all day long a chance to look at things with a different perspective, and we'll get into how that works and how effective that is in a little bit. My guests today are Greg Ellis Valencia. He's the executive director of One Cool Earth, and Victoria Carranza, and she's the educational director of One Cool Earth, also referred to, I noticed in some of your notes, as OCE, I guess, for people who don't want to say One Cool Earth all the time. But that's cool. We're going to discuss basically the value of outdoor education. And this is something that, yes, this sounds like another concept about, let's talk about having a vegetable garden at the local school. It's not about that. And that's really, well, it's sort of about that, but not about that in the way you might have thought about that before. Greg, let me start with you. Give me some background in the organization. Tell us about why it exists and what brought it about.
Well, thank you, Fred. I have been working with One Cool Earth as a volunteer and finally a paid person for the last probably about 10 years. Well, it started long before that, though. It started back in 2001 under the auspices of Chris and Sue Elliott and a local Lionel Johnson. And Lionel is really our local Johnny Appleseed character. Maybe some of the listeners have heard of the book The Man Who Planted Trees, The Lorax. Lionel Johnson is a living myth, and he's dedicated. Yep.
Does he know he's referred to by the executive director as a living myth? Okay, all right, okay.
Yeah, he's beyond legend. He's myth. So he's really dedicated his full-time existence to planting native trees, and he has been an enormous influence and an enormous mentor in my life, but all around the community here. If you see a tree along the street, there's probably a 50% chance that Lionel had something to do with that tree being planted. So I began volunteering with him about 10 years ago, and he really took me under his wing and really got me outside, got me to know the different parts of this county, you know, all the way from out in the Carissa Plains to the coast and north and south. And I was a Cal Poly student at the time, and I was just graduating with an English degree. Well, I found out that Lionel had started a nonprofit. He really is more of a man who is working if he has a shovel in his hand. He's less interested in sitting in an office and maybe doing the necessary work that supports getting out and doing the vital work. So I really wanted to continue the work I was doing with him, and so I said, hey, let me try to write grants with you guys and we'll see where we can take this. And since then, it's been a lot of challenges, and but we've really made it work, and we figured out how we could support his work and expand upon it.
So a lot of this is focused now on elementary schools predominantly, but also middle schools and high schools. I'd heard about your program before we asked you to come to the radio program, because it so happens my wife, most listeners of the show know that my wife's a middle school teacher in Paso Robles, and she had met you because you've done some gardening work with students. It's not about just planting a garden. From her perspective, it was about getting kids out doing things that they may not be familiar with, but gets them away from what for a lot of the kids is a frustrating environment of being in a classroom when they don't really like to be there.
That's right. And, you know, I'm thrilled to find out who your wife is. I remember she was a sponsor for our garden club at Flampson a couple years ago. So Flampson was a school, you know, it's got a really nice new building there that was built after the earthquake in Paso, but they had an empty space right next to the building. It was used as the staging ground for the construction, just a flat dirt space. Well, we came in 3 years ago, and we worked with a class there, and we came up with a plan with the students. We redesigned that space. They decided where the pathways would go. They decided where to put the plants with some help from ourselves, and they built a huge garden there, a 4,000-foot native and vegetable garden. And since then, we've used that space really to engage students in understanding the greater part of our world. Most of the world we live in is wild. It is ecosystems. It's plants. It's creating the air and the water and the soil that we depend on to really sustain life. So we've used this area as an exploratory laboratory where kids can look into the curiosity and the inspiration of that world directly.
Yeah. I guess, Victoria, the concepts that you're working with for a lot of people may fall in the category of we don't have enough time in our school day to teach the things we really need to teach, and the funding for schools is going down. So how do you, when you're talking to a school or reaching out to a school about putting this together, give them the opportunity to really understand how it will connect with what they're doing?
Right, and that's something that I can relate to all the time when I work at various school sites, elementary, middle, high school. I try to come from the perspective that it's not that the teachers or the parents or the principals are disinterested in the outdoor spaces. Quite frankly, they remind us all the time. They're really appreciative that we're there and have a presence on their campus of sustaining or upkeeping or doing direct ed or helping them co-teach. And, you know, a lot of times they run out of time throughout the day to lesson plan, let alone bring us in. And how do you control 30 kids in an outdoor classroom space when you're used to teaching in your own room that you have a controlled environment? You know, we're asking them to not just teach a different subject or try something new out, but I mean, we're asking them to completely reframe the way they take the students out and how much we can get done in that time period. I mean, you don't want to do a lot of the heavy lifting for them when you're out there. You want them to explore the phenomenon, and you want them to do a lot of their own investigation. So it's a little different concept, but I think we just a lot of the time are just going where the teachers need us to go. I mean, whether that's coordinating on a calendar in their teacher's lounge or whether that's meeting them and providing some technical assistance after school and going to their classroom, dropping by for 10, 15 minutes, just giving them that confidence boost that they need that you can do this. And what do you need to be successful out here? Organizing gloves. You would have no idea how much time that takes. Or washing hands, you know? Yeah.
Before I forget, and because I have not mentioned it at this point, and I apologize to our listeners, this is a call-in program, and you're welcome to be part of the discussion. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. If you want to be part of this discussion, you have questions or observations you'd like to share with us, please do that. I encourage you to call in early in the program. We often have callers calling in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the program, and it's hard to really give you the time and attention for your interest that you'd like. So just give us a call if you'd like. So you're working with about 40 elementary schools, or I guess your goal is to work with 40 elementary schools.
That's right.
Over a 5-year plan. How many are you currently working with, and what kind of interesting responses have you gotten from the schools? Obviously, we'd like the response for the kids, too, but I'm wondering how you get responded to by school boards, principals, classroom teachers who believe there's not enough time anyway. Where do you want to start?
All right. We're both pointing at each other if the listeners are wondering what's happening.
Yeah, it's like, okay, you take it
you
first.
It.
No, you take it first. Okay.
So, I think that I personally am aware of when teachers come to us or when we come to them that sometimes they look at it as, oh, man, this might distract us from getting this standard in, or, oh, no, like, how am I going to fit this time in? And they have certain minimum criteria of what they need to cover in a day. I mean, I'm flabbergasted and so respect. It's like a choreography. It's a dance that goes on every single day in schools. But I think the more that we get connected to the principals and the school site, we start understanding that, there's a direct connection of how much we can support them with funding, with resources. We need them to occupy the spaces outside in order for us to rationalize being able to support their campuses, whether that's green operations like composting or whether that's getting out to learn from the space and having educational, resources in the garden, having a greenhouse, So I think that they're willing to work with us. They're very flexible from what I've noticed. But getting the commitment from the school districts and the principals, I think, is where it's at. But you also want to have that willpower and that empowerment from, down below too.
From what you're presenting and how you're presenting it, my assumption would be that you're not asking schools to commit funds to this project as much as you're asking schools to commit space and time and the commitment of students. I mean, you'd like schools that can help you fund the program, but you have a lot of foundations and things that are providing some grant money for you.
Yeah, I definitely think that our goal is to have some of the school districts maybe subsidize a portion, but we certainly are looking for matching and beyond matching for these school districts that we're working in. And bringing in parents and volunteers are huge resources, and aligning the teachers with the teachers who are the experts in education, frankly, of how they're going to meet their standards. We're providing the backdrop and the foundation for them with these outdoor classrooms.
Wow, it's a challenging project, I'm sure, in a lot of ways, because you
big puzzle.
Yeah. we live in a semi-rural county, in that it's even city kids in Paso Robles, city kids in San Luis Obispo, city kids in Santa Barbara. There are still 4-H and FFA programs in a lot of these communities, which is something that large city kids like LA and San Francisco don't seem to get an opportunity for. Are you dealing at all with kids who have had no experience or have no idea about what it's like to plant and look after any kind of agricultural needs?
I'd say it's amazing how disconnected not just the students, but myself. I feel like I am learning about the food system as I teach to the students. I'm learning more and more about where our food comes from, what it actually takes to run a productive garden. I think we don't have agricultural backgrounds ourselves, so we're learning these rhythms of when you need to plant. If you plant a couple of weeks too late, you're not going to get the same yields.
There goes your brassicas.
Or if you plant too early, you're going to get frost. And it's using these gardens and outdoor spaces as just kind of a window into this larger world. It's really a microcosm of these greater systems, how we get our food, how we get our water. And it's delightful how the kids, they can taste it. They can get their hands dirty in it. you know, it's being imprinted on their memory. They're really getting that deep connection with these systems. Yeah.
I've seen the project that you put in at Flamsen, okay? And one of the things that comes to mind, I don't know if this has been a factor or not, but I suspect it has. Kids tend to be somewhat cavalier and flip about their surroundings. They throw trash around. They leave stuff around. I'm wondering if that kind of environment, because my thought is the one at Flamsen that I'm aware of, you can't – it's off to the side a little bit. But if you're going from a major part of the school to the other side of the school, you can't not see it. Mm-hmm. My thought is kids that may have been involved – last semester in working on that garden, see one of their friends throw a water bottle, and just toss it in the garden, figuring it doesn't matter. I'm wondering if that kind of awareness has been something that this has propagated.
Well, when we first built that garden, there was no fence around it. It's an open garden, and there was a lot of concern that students would come in and vandalize the garden and pull up plants and trample things. Well, We were fortunate enough to work with a certain class at that school that had some of the students who might, you know, be most at risk of doing those sorts of things. But by involving them from the very beginning, we didn't have any instances of vandalism for a couple of years, and by that time those students were gone. And we have seen, you know, the students who are involved in our garden club, they tell us that their view of the world has changed. They look differently at a piece of trash on the ground, or, you know, maybe when they're running the water at home for no purpose. They're viewing these resources differently because of their experience in the garden.
Yeah. Let me remind you, we are talking with Greg Ellis Valencia and Victoria Carranza, pardon me, I'm sorry. I notoriously completely destroy names all the time. I do apologize. They're the executive director and the education director with One Cool Earth, a wonderful local organization working with schools and school students on building community gardens and community gardens on their schools and then beyond that. If you'd like to be part of this discussion, the phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. We would love you to be part of this ongoing dialogue about this. So I suspect you have an elementary school. We won't name any communities. We don't, because some communities only have one elementary school. And you've approached that principal or maybe a school board member or somebody in the administration you know, and you want to start a program at that school. Give me the elevator speech as to why this is important. The elevator speech. The one that I want you to be able to convince me that I want to hear more, and I've only got like 45 seconds right now, so please explain to me why in the world I want to hear anymore. Okay. And both of my guests are looking at each other and saying, oh, well, okay, anyway, go ahead.
Well, fortunately, we're not coming in as outsiders, so yeah. We usually have connections within the districts. And, it's taken a while to build these connections. But usually we just say, hey, look, Paso Robles is doing it. And all the other schools get jealous and they say, well, wait,
there's
Paso's
a little bit
doing
of like
it.
A,
we want to do
yeah,
it too.
Like a rivalry. Healthy competition. And it lowers the risk factor for us because we've piloted pretty much all the programs that we're wanting to do at their schools. So, if they want to go to those schools, we just take them to those schools. But oftentimes the 45-second thing, we're walking through the hallway as we're talking to principals or, okay, we go into a meeting and, only have actually 10 minutes instead of an hour. Whoops. So, the 45-second speech. That's intimidating.
That's just an example from that standpoint.
Yeah.
I'm wondering because teachers and administrators, they have a limited number of funds. Our school, we'll all agree that our schools are somewhat underfunded or marginally funded, and it's tough to do. But we have to look at the concept of, please explain to me that this is a valuable program. It might sound really great, but is it valuable enough for me to commit space and commitment of staff to work with you and coordinate this and physical space on the campus to do this?
Yeah, I think that's basically what we're asking for a lot of the time is we would like to consistently have a presence on your campus, do a project-based learning opportunity, maybe one, maybe multiple during the school year, whether it's setting up a compost system and doing a waste audit for the school campus, or it's going in and saying, we want to remove turf and actually doing a rain garden project, or we want to do a watershed education program where we come in and do 10 lessons throughout the year, and we're going to install a rain tank, and we're going to make sure that, you know, the kids help build that. So we need access to the facilities. We need access to, you know, talking to your grounds and your principal and being and them being open to allowing us access, because we know that they covet a lot of their time and they have so many different priorities going on. But integration is really, I think, where we hit it with them is we want to integrate into what you're already doing. So yeah. We look at that before we come in.
Okay. Because, well, one of the things that we would apply as I think about this is, what can we do that's an initial project specifically that if it doesn't work out, doesn't leave me, I'm the principal of School X, with a quarter acre of dead plants next year mm-hmm. when the project doesn't continue. So the fact that you mentioned, among other things, composting is an early part of this. Composting probably takes a lot more maintenance than people realize.
Oh, yeah.
Except for the fact that if you stop composting, what you have left
is compost.
Is compost, okay? And yeah. At worst, some dry dirt that you have to move, as opposed to a dead garden.
Sure.
So mm-hmm. composting programs is one of the tools that you can work with as an introductory program.
Yeah, I'd say that we've even done smaller footprint introductory programs. Mm-hmm. You know, the key words that the principals and the teachers want to hear are standards and curriculum. And we have done our homework. Our lessons are, you know, coordinated with the standards and the curriculum that they need to meet already. And we're really just bringing a tool to their campus that they can decide how to use it. We try to be pretty flexible with how we schedule it and what form it takes in the end. But, you know, we have this toolkit that they can use as they see fit.
But I think you're right. I heard something earlier that you said of what's convincing me that, okay, this sounds great this year, but then what's going to happen next year yeah. when you have falling fruit after you put in, you know, some awesome plants and, oh boy, now they're rotting, or, oh, our drip system, you know, because the groundskeeper goes, oh, they retrofitted that, so it should be their project. So they didn't check it. And pretty soon we find out all of our strawberries on the ground and our native plants are like, not having a good time, or maybe they're being flooded, you know, who's checking on those? But I think that that's what our program's trying to address, is being that consistent presence and re-inspiring the next cohort of individuals, whether that's a new class, a new teacher, a new champion parent, getting funding for the garden coordinator to keep going on that campus. I mean, we really want to not hold the school's hand, but we want to consistently just empower and inspire them to nurture what we've put in.
Yeah, keep that thought.
Okay.
We'll get back to that because we have Bruce in Morro Bay. Are you with us, Bruce?
I am.
Okay, jump in the discussion.
Well, I'm so enthused to hear about One Cool Earth because 25 years ago, my wife and I were both veteran teachers, and we moved to some acreage right off of Highway 1 between Cuesta College and Morro Bay, right on San Luisito Creek. And when we moved there, my wife noticed that the whole along the highway there for a mile was all trash and weeds, and working through Caltrans in the county, she used her students and brought her middle school students from Laguna out, and she did it 2 or 3 days in a row, and they planted over 100 trees
wow.
for a little more than 1 mile along Highway 1. And then my wife and I watered and maintained those trees until, and we got the neighbors involved, and then now 25 years later, the trees are 30, 40 feet high. And also we had help from Lionel Johnson, we just called him the tree man back in that day. But he came and he gave us He gave us oats, which we planted on our property, but he stressed the importance of using native trees. So all along the highway there, if you drive along Highway 1 and you get across from Hollister Peak, you'll see these 30, 40-foot trees that are sycamores and oaks and pines and redwoods. And those were all via the inspiration from Lionel Johnson and also San Luis Coastal School District via my wife, Nancy Bedrigian, and getting on the highway with her students planting trees that now I hope those students enjoy and the rest of us continue to enjoy.
Bruce, this is Fred here. Yeah, question for you. Does your wife still get any feedback from maybe former students that talk about having seen those? And the legacy of that seems like it would be something that would carry over and would be very beneficial for students today.
Well, one of the nice things that Laguna, that Caltrans did is they put up a sign that says, look, tree planting project, Laguna Middle School and Friends. And it just reminds us and reminds the students when they drive by. Of course, they're adults and have their own families now, but they can see that sign and they can point to children and say, look, I planted that tree. Yeah, it was only, 6 inches, 8 inches tall, but look at it now. And it's pretty amazing legacy, like you said. So the young people you have with you today, yes, persevere. Get into the school districts. Teachers want to help. Talk to Eric Prater, the superintendent for San Luis Coastal, who I believe is a visionary and is motivated, would love to get in on a project like this. But there's other administrators and teachers that are 100% behind you guys.
Bruce, thanks for the call.
Thank you,
You're
Bruce.
Welcome.
Thank you. That's very inspirational to
hear
about.
Yeah.
That's a great ecological service that he provided. And those kids know that they actually could start doing something before they graduate and become an adult. I think that's the biggest aha moment.
So how many schools are you in now?
We're going into a few more next year. So I think we're at about 12 currently on a regular basis. And it could mean anything from having a school garden or a compost system to simply being in the classroom and teaching about the outdoors and doing hands-on activities in the classroom that are about the outdoors.
Yeah. I was thinking what you were saying a couple of minutes ago, Victoria, about learning what it takes to maintain it and be responsible for it. And as you were saying that, it occurred to me, it had not occurred to me before. Oh yeah, we're talking about things that need attention all the time and schools don't have students and teachers on them for at least 2.5 to 3 months during the summer and a couple of weeks in the winter and a couple of weeks in the spring. Do you enlist student help in the summertime to look after things, and how do you?
Yeah, I definitely could take that on because it's happening right now, like this very day. I'm coordinating with students and families and programs that we partner with because we can't do it alone. So we rely on, the other folks and organizations and individuals that are extensions of us. For instance, in Paso Robles, there is a summer program that operates on top of summer school, and they usually provide after-school care. And so we've taken those school sites that they're doing programs at from 8 in the morning until 5 o'clock at night, where they have a lot of human capital, and we're saying, hey, like, let's do some programs in there, and let's have you actually feed the worms and take care. We rely on... what's another one throughout the summer? Integrated Waste Management Authority. The groups that can care for some of the other bins that are non-operational during the summer that need feeding or watering, a little moisture, not a ton, but just the wormies that need them. Sometimes we, go in and just look at the school sites that we plant crops that need low maintenance, because it is important to us, because we realize the summer is the high peak season where you should be growing food. But if you don't have students in them, you don't want to be growing stuff that needs harvesting, and no kid is going to get access to that abundance over the summer. So planting things right before the kids leave and doing it with them, but just monitoring the growth pattern and then ready for them to harvest for back to school night is huge. So minimal volunteer work days is something that we focus on in the summertime, where we recruit those parents and those community groups. Like First Five is another one. We have lots of different orgs.
You talk about a product of the fruits of the project, if you will, fruits and vegetables that actually grow and can be harvested. In a lot of cases, it seems like you're also dealing with what I would classify as decorative plants, basically just landscaping type plants and things like that.
Yeah, ornamentals or perennials.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you get a better response from kids when you're growing something that's edible?
The great thing about ornamental native plants is that they have a history to them that goes beyond their ornamental. The native plants around here have a 10,000-year history of use by the native peoples of this area. So we can plant something like black sage that just smells really great, has beautiful flowers, attracts all kinds of wildlife. But it was also this plant that was used medicinally by the Chumash who lived in the area. And so it's another, you know, you can connect with them aesthetically. The kids really are, as they learn to become adults, they want to learn self-sufficiency. So teaching about native people and the use of native plants gives them that, you know, boost.
And different functions in the garden. You look at the different characteristics of plants. That's a key component. And you don't want just, you know, tilling and reharvesting and tilling. You need that backdrop, and you need those pollinators, and you need to attract them somehow. So, yeah, and water retention on the side banks of whatever you're growing in.
Cool. Let me remind folks, we're talking today with the executive director and the educational director of One Cool Earth, an organization that by its name kind of implies what it is. It's about One Cool Earth, and it's working with kids and communities on environmental projects related to agriculture and outside education, if you will. I laugh, Greg. You mentioned the word garden club. Okay, in my mind, a garden club translates into a bunch of senior citizens sitting around and talking about what they want to plant in the community garden. And you're talking about working with elementary school kids and junior high school kids. Are you getting, what kind of response are you getting from community people who've never seen this kind of thing going on before? And you know, all of a sudden you have some grandparents maybe showing up that are talking about what they can do beyond what their kids are doing. Does that come up, and how's that working?
That's a great analogy or a great parallel, because we do work with both kinds of clubs, and both kinds of clubs support us.
Different garden clubs, yeah.
Now, at the schools, the garden club is really an extracurricular thing that happens during lunch, and there's certain, you know, students, especially at the middle school level, they're coming out of elementary, they're figuring out which clique they can hang out with, what are the things they enjoy doing. And the garden provides a space for students who might not be as extroverted and might not be as social. They can be friends with a plant instead of having to worry about
honestly,
what to say.
One just beelines it for the greenhouse, and he just wants to do propagation, or he just wants to do seed saving, and he's like, oh, give me that bowl that we were working on last week, and I want to go collect these things. Or they just want to just be in a safe place, yeah, and just breathe a little, literally.
Yeah. Recently at a social function, I ran into somebody who used to spend a lot of time working with kids on apple grafting. Okay. And he said he said he thought kids would never get involved in it, and he discovered it was something that kids really liked, because it was for kids who were not into plants, they were into mechanical stuff. It was kind of a mechanical operation to learn how to graft and get things to propagate.
It has a little bit of a risk to it, which I think kids appreciate. They want to be responsible for things.
Well, we've worked with the rare fruit growers, and they do an amazing apple grafting program where they provide all the supervision, the knives, the rootstock, the scion, and we've put knives in the hands of students who teachers probably wouldn't want to have knives in their hands. And those students have really, you know, done a great job and just proven their responsibility. It takes a lot of trust, and when you give them that trust, they respond in kind.
Cool. I want to remind you, this is a call-in program. If you'd like to give us a call, as Bruce did a little while ago, the phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. We're talking about working with children and school students primarily who are involved in the One Cool Earth program of basically outdoor education related around agriculture. Is there an opportunity? I mean, we have a lot of people in this county who are involved in agriculture. You may have a lot of kids in the Paso Robles area where we've talked about it, because that's what I'm familiar with, whose parents may work in the wine industry. They may work in the olive oil industry. There's industry up there that's very committed to agriculture, and my hunch is a lot of these kids, all they know about agriculture in some cases may be, my parents do this every day and come home exhausted, and I don't, why do I want to do that?
I might not want that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do you overcome those kinds of challenges?
We have had a lot of involvement from the agricultural community in some of our programs. One of the teachers I work with in Paso, she's at least a second, if not a third generation agriculturalist. She went to Cal Poly and studied ag, and she knows so much about the history of agriculture in the area. She's able to connect that with our lessons when we go outside. The wineries and the vineyards, they're, you know, a mainstay of some of our support. They send volunteers to our schools. They sponsor us. They've been very supportive. There are a lot of farmers who are interested in our work and congratulate us.
There's like a few places that I almost like want to take that. And it's like with, you know, we have some people that we bring in to guest speak, you know, that are people that are from the industry, and we want them to talk about the challenges and the excitement. And if you talk to some of our local people, like I remember talking to a nonprofit that's focused on the City Farm project out here, and she reminded me that we're running into problems with, we don't have enough people coming up that are young that are going to grow our food. And who's going to take on that role of managing our lands and growing nutritious foods for us? Like, it's kind of scary. So as much as we can, we have this presence, I think, when we're on campus, where it's literally cool to be outside, and it's much more than just getting in there and doing a mundane task and not knowing why you're doing it. Sometimes that's, I think, a lot of what we think about agriculture, you know, just get out there and pick that up, or get out there and seed that. But I mean, it's biodiversity, it's nature connection, it's everything. So, and it enhances their academic learning. So we're not just necessarily talking about growing food, you know, and talking about agriculture. So I think that's how I would address that for parents that might be like, oh, I don't know if this is good for my student. I don't want them to maybe go down that road. I want them to get into the books, and I don't want them to go out and have to work outside, you know? So
yeah, I think we hear about that a lot. I think most generations and most parents would like a better life for their kids than they have. And there's even some very successful families obviously still feel like, oh, there's things that I would have liked to have been better, and so I'd like it a little better, not necessarily easier, but more rewarding for my children. So I think that's probably what you're addressing.
Yeah, that's also a little bit of the edge that I was feeling on that, because it's come up before, you know, personal conversations or just thoughts that I've had with my grandfather working out in the fields most of his life. So, yeah.
Okay, so I'm the principal at this now imaginary elementary school, and you have thoroughly convinced me that what you want to do is a great alternative and good for my students. And tell me how in the world I fit it into my educational day. We start at 7:45 in the morning. We're done at 3:15 in the afternoon. My teachers are all overworked and have more to do as far as after school and before school stuff. And the average kid wants to get off campus 3 seconds before the bell rings, not 3 seconds after the bell rings. So where do we fit this into our day?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, Principal Monroe, I think we're just the organization you've been looking for. We're not here to bring anything additional to your responsibilities and your worries. We're really here to, with a lot of humility, listen to what would help your teachers, and we're here to be of service to them and provide for them. And we see ourselves as a bridge between the school and the resources that are out in the community, but they take a little bit of effort that maybe is above and beyond an overworked teacher to get in there, and we would like to work with your teachers and support them in that way.
So let's look at your list of staff.
I'm
looking at the clock.
Yeah,
saying,
I know.
Where
and
we
it's
fit
like,
this in.
I see that there's someone parked in the parking spot they shouldn't be, and you probably need to get that. So let's just wrap this up. Let's actually walk out together since we have more time together.
Okay.
This is literally what happens.
Okay.
But, you know, so we have staff members of yours. Can you give me a few that you think would make a good fit to work with us? You know, someone who has flexibility, who's curious about outdoors, who you think would be a good fit with this. Okay. You gave me a few names. It looks like we have a dance teacher. Looks like we have a science, you know, sixth grade teacher. And it looks like, you know, a lot of times that's what happens. We find certain teachers. So then we look at what unit can we fit this into? And then we just skew a different lens on it. Can you teach language by doing Venn diagrams and then comparing and contrasting the different compost bins? Or can we look at art and can we do drawing? Can we look at PE games, drip, drip, drench, and do water conservation? I mean, honestly, that we get really creative on that because it's not about teaching just what we want.
I didn't know there was a game called drip, drip.
It's drench, like Duck, Duck, Goose.
Okay.
It's pretty good. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, well, this is still a hard question for me. So you're talking about committing some classroom time for certain students to be doing this instead of what they would be doing.
Okay,
in the classroom.
That's okay. The key.
The instead of becomes tough because I don't know if I've
got it. Not be instead of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd say in support of.
Okay.
We want to know when your teachers have to teach the fifth grade curriculum about carbon cycles or about nutrient cycles. And when they're teaching that curriculum, we will come in and we will help them. We'll bring experiments, we'll bring staff who will help them do more hands-on group activities that are difficult with a one adult to 30 student ratio. We'll bring in funding and we'll take a field trip to the ocean when we learn about the water cycle or when we're learning about marine life. We'll work with your class during lunch when it isn't interfering with instructional minutes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we need a teacher advisor to actually, you know,
commit to
being an advisor for the club.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Could be that.
Yeah, I'm looking at a
after
note.
After school.
Yeah, I'm looking at a note from a caller here because actually when I see an out-of-state caller, that usually means someone who either A, is addicted to the internet and therefore listens to us that way, and I think that, or B, is somehow connected to the program and they're
could
not
be
telling
both.
Us.
Yeah.
So we have Chris from Austin, as in Texas. You're on the air. Go ahead and jump in here, Chris.
So, Greg and Victoria, if you had unlimited funds to execute what you're doing, what would you do?
Oh.
Wait, I'll back up. Chris,
did you
bring your checkbook?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do have a hidden agenda here. I am actually part of the start of this, and I'm blessed with these two directors, and I thought this would be a perfect place to chide them into how big do they want to go and how many people's lives do they want to change.
Okay, so, I'll duck and get out of the way.
Question.
Go ahead.
Unlimited funds.
Okay.
Well, right now we are very restricted by our funding. We depend on grants that, you know, have limited funding, and they restrict the kinds of activities that we can do. If we had a funder who would give us unlimited funds for whatever purposes we'd want, we see going to elementary schools and really creating robust outdoor education programs at those schools as kind of the sweet spot. Elementary is an age when students are really shaping their, not only their values and their norms, their interests, their taste in food, the eating habits that are going to affect their health into the future. We would go to those schools and we would not make ourselves indispensable. We would work at those schools for a set amount of time to help the school incorporate those systems, incorporate outdoor education and gardening, so then we could step back and we wouldn't need unlimited funds. We just need a set amount of funding for a certain amount of time, and then we could step back. So,
good. Chris, thank you. Anything else to add to the mix?
No, I've worked with Greg and Victoria for a couple of years now, with Victoria and Greg for a longer period of time. And what I see what they're doing is a much needed program. As we look at these climate change issues, food is probably one of the most important things. And what they're really doing is preparing people, and especially this younger generation, to understand their footprint in that food cycle, because it's going to be part of their future. So I'm just very proud to be part of this with them. And if I do my job right, I stay invisible and they keep growing.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Chris, and thanks for the points. Well taken.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah.
Yeah, something came
we'll
up.
Find out why he's in Texas later on, but that's a different story.
Our guiding godfather, I guess. Okay. He's just an amazing director.
He brings up an interesting point that I hadn't thought about, and that is there a game plan for the way what you do to become somehow an elective in school?
You mean an elective?
Middle school, in elementary school, you don't have electives necessarily. No. But in middle school and high school, there's only so many periods in the day, but there's also for some kids, none of the electives appeal to me. I don't want another computer class. I already know more than the computer
guy
teacher
does. I mean, we're
already
doing that. I mean, Greg has a good example at the continuation high school that he worked at, the first real nursery he got started in school.
Yeah, so we came in 5 years ago. It was the very first school I worked at, and we had the students create a full-scale native plant nursery. And they would come out a few times a week, and they'd work there. We'd collect seed. We'd grow the seed in pots.
As a horticulture.
And plant sale.
Right?
Yeah, so that's a school. That program is still going on. They have dedicated a teacher, dedicated class time to outdoor education.
But even before that, what did you do with the principal to even make that possible?
It was more of a teacher who was really,
okay,
really interested. And, I think that we want to see outdoor education integrated not only just as an elective, but we want to see it integrated in food services. In Paso Robles, we have a great example of a food director, Greg Wongard, who has prioritized gardens as a part of his way of getting kids to eat healthier. And we've been able to support that in the school gardens. We're talking with the curriculum director about how any class can come out and use the garden during a particular unit when it fits in well.
Yeah, I'm thinking Paso Robles has actually, they have a food service school program as part of the high school.
Culinary Arts Academy,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that would be a great thing to tie in. It hadn't even occurred to me because sustainable agriculture has become more important. Farm to table. I mean, there are billboards for local restaurants that talk about how special farm to table things are for them.
Yeah.
And that becomes a big factor too. So, so as the principal, I've decided this is going to work really great. And we're going to fit it in somehow. And I found you one teacher who's going to agree to work with you. And how do I make it fit in the day? Because I don't necessarily have periods available. So if I've got kids working on it during lunch, that's great. But how do I get this as a sustainable program? Because 20 minutes at lunch every day is not enough.
And we might actually look at, too, like this summer, what we did was we worked with the Atascadero Unified School District, and they had invited us to do an extension of their next generation science standard. And they had a cap, I think, of they had 28 teachers from different K through sixth, all throughout their district. And then we did a 1 hour extension of outdoor opportunities that would connect those science standards. And some of the teachers didn't know we existed. Some of the teachers got intimidated by school gardens, but then they came out thinking, wow, now I could just actually take the kids under a tree or do a nature walk around my campus, you know, and looking at butterfly gardens that they could just adopt a concrete planter bed, you know.
And they can do a field trip to the garden where you and other students can talk about what's going on.
So I think school site, you know, trainings or school site touring is a way of saying, you know, Mr. Monroe, you know, maybe it's possible that there's more teachers that would be willing. They just don't understand exactly what we're talking about. They think school gardens and they think, oh my God, that's a huge overwhelm and task and responsibility. I can't fit it in. Yeah. Maybe that's not true.
And once you decide to work with us, we have a strategy to this. We're not just kind of winging it. Our strategy is really to increase the infrastructure at your site, make sure you have a school garden space. And if you don't, we'll find the funding and we'll work with your students to build it. We'll provide direct education.
Those are operative words that I need to hear, which is you'll help find the funding. And
yes.
And I'm not being sarcastic about that. I think that becomes a big factor.
But it's that relationship where we can actually work with you to partner when we ghostwrite it and when we seek that funding out. We need to be able to, we have access to all your teachers and you.
So. We're running a little short on time and we have Rosemary, you're still there. I wanted to make sure we get a chance for your call in here.
Yes, I'm still here.
Go ahead. Jump in. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to say that my introduction to gardening started when I was 8 years old and our family moved from East LA where we had no yard of any kind to a lovely corner space in a house. And my dad put in a beautiful garden with three rows and then a walkway and three rows and a walkway. And my job was to move the hose at that time so that it filled up in between the vegetables. But I didn't get paid for that. What I did get paid for by my grandmother was a nickel for a bucket of weeds. And that was the first money I earned in my life. I can remember it so vividly. And the smell of vegetables growing like that, I learned to identify what they were. I ate a tomato, vine ripe tomato, didn't even wash it, just ate it like an apple. You could eat an ear of corn the same way.
I love these images.
It started a lifetime love of gardening. And even one of my sisters is a master gardener up in Napa. I mean, I couldn't imagine not having a compost pile or trying all kinds of different plants, not just vegetables and fruits, but flowers also. So even though it started as a lucrative, you know, nickel a bucket, it was a big bucket for a nickel. It's how you can inspire kids in whatever way possible. And I know that our family, we were kind of poor, and my parents went into orchards and fields, and they gleaned a lot of fruit and vegetable after the pickers had been, and it was a lot cheaper then. And then my mom canned a lot of the fruit and the vegetables. So I had a very early positive introduction, which could happen at the school level if it's not happening at the home level.
Yeah, very good point, Rosemary. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Take care. Yeah, it's somebody obviously who did it very young, and it's a legacy that's held on. And
she can. I love what Rosemary said. I couldn't imagine not having this, you know, because what we're doing is, I think, changing their reality of what's the norm.
Yeah,
you know.
We're down to the last few minutes. As I promised both of you that I would, I didn't word it quite this way, but the bottom line is I'll be quiet for at least a couple of minutes so you can pretty much cover whatever we haven't covered that you think is very important. Victoria, I'll start with you.
Okay. Well, I just think, like, Greg and I were chatting a little bit before we got here, and my background is natural resource management and environmental planning, that kind of thing. And so I really love this challenge of working with the public schools sector because I think what part of our role is bridging the facilities and the curriculum departments together and seeing that they're not different departments. I mean, they need to be, obviously, there's certain things in the background. You want to move curb lips to not trip kids, and you want to make sure that there's no puddles in certain places, or, you know, there's those things that don't need to involve curriculum. And likewise with facilities, like, they don't need to know every standard for math. But I think that these grounds can be looked at as the teacher themselves. These campuses, we can instill more pride in communities by transforming these campuses and landscapes. We can get the kids to have a better well-being just by exposing them and forming relationships with non-human things. Soil can be the textbook, you know? And then we, you know, can make a better well-being for the teachers. That transcends down to their ability to hold space and teach and be de-stressed when they're out there with the kids throughout the entire day. So,
good point. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Greg, you get the last word.
Well, I just want to reach out to the listeners. You know, we don't do this alone. We do this with so many partners. And if you would like to get involved, you can really, you don't have to be involved in one of our programs. There's many good environmental, many good agricultural, outdoor education programs in the county. Mm-hmm. And we're probably all supporting each other, if not directly, which many of them are, then indirectly. And your time is the most valuable thing to a lot of these organizations. You can give us $100, or you can volunteer for half a day. Your time is really worth that much. And if you can volunteer on a regular basis over a long period of time, that just saves tons of money.
Yeah. Well, I think about it. You had the last word, but you left one thing out. I'm curious about it. What do you need teachers and administrators to start doing if they haven't heard from you yet and they want to do something like this? What can they do to get started at their schools and contact you?
Sure. I'd say the best contact is through our website, www.onecoolearth, that's onecoolearth.org, so it's .org, or you can call us 760, area code 382-5164.
Yeah, we'll make sure that's also on the KCBX website, because people can hear the program. It'll be archived in a couple of days, so there'll be an opportunity for that also.
And we also have projects that are updated all the time with pictures on our Facebook page and just what we're actually doing on the ground every week.
People can like you on Facebook and then hear more about it.
One Cool Earth is the page name.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should not be hard to find. It's an unusual organization name.
You love that name. Yeah. I can tell.
I do. It's great. Hey, I'm a hippie child of the 60s. It's okay. Yeah. Anyway, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for
listening, folks. Want to remind you that Action for Healthy Communities is the organization, part of the Community Foundation, that helps us put this together. You can find a copy of the report, Vital Signs, Understanding San Luis Obispo County, at actionslo.org. It's a free report that you're welcome to look at. Last one came out in December of 2013. The newest report will be out this December of 2016. Gives you a really good snapshot of the county and what's going on. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be here, and she'll be speaking with Heidi Bocher, who's the writer, producer, and director of a documentary film called The Parlor, The Final Goodbye. And they will discuss how individuals, with the support and guidance of their families and communities, are being cared for after their death at home. Yes, it sounds like a very unusual topic. The documentary film The Parlor, The Final Goodbye, shares the intimate story of three individuals and who, like a growing number of families, are in search of a more personal and fulfilling way to say goodbye to their loved ones. These people are rejecting the mainstream tradition of hiring professional funeral directors, and the documentary really looks at this growing growth for these families to find ways to say goodbye that goes beyond the typical way. Sounds very unusual, maybe one of the most unusual topics we've ever had. Mm-hmm. So join Chris next week. Remind you again, we're a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a collaboration with San Luis Obispo Community Foundation and KCBX Public Radio. You can contact us at voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. And thank you to Joan Gellert Sargent, who underwrites this every single month, so we have the money for production expenses. And thank you to my guests, Greg and Victoria, today. This has been Central Coast Voices.
Way cool.
Thank you so much.
Way cool.